Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome everyone to the show. I'm sitting here today with Jonathan Krause from Love Never Fails International. Jonathan, how you doing today, bud?
I'm doing great, Travis. I'm so glad to be with you and your listeners today. How are you doing?
Man, I'm doing fantastic. If I said anything else, I'd be lying. I want to talk to you. I had a great time talking about Love Never Fails International. You do most of your work in India, and we're going to talk today about how to multiply your staff, develop leaders, and actually delegate so you don't have to do everything. But why don't you give us a little bit of background on Love Never Fails International and what it is that you do?
Yeah, sure thing, Travis. Well, Love Never Fails International, our main thing is to take children out of poverty. You know, so many studies show that if you can give a child an education in India, you're going to take him farther away from poverty. But if you can give a child an English education in India to a child living in poverty, then he can get to middle class or higher. So we're focused on that. We provide the essential needs that these kids don't have, but through a generous sponsor in America, they're given to them. And we've seen amazing stories of transformation with these children that are living in little tin shacks in the slums or orphan, where their parents died of HIV, sex traffic. And it's still to this day, 12 years later, I'm so passionate about this work.
You know, it's nice that when we decide to actually do something that has an impact, it has a way of not taking from us, but helping fill us back up. I absolutely love that. We've had a few conversations now. We've talked in depth about leadership, and it's one of those words that people study and some people do. But when you have like a real discussion, you have a real analysis on the topic, it really changes how you think and feel. And we were having our pre-discussion before I hit the record button, and Jonathan's over here taking notes. I'm like, this is great. I love it. That's what is supposed to happen when you have these discussions. Because the real leaders understand that they're not going to have all the answers. There's always something new to learn. And if you do it right, they might just surprise you. So what do you have to talk about today? We've got a few different things. You were living in India for like 7 years. Is that right?
So I lived in India for 7 years. I picked up Hindi language. My wife is Marathi. Woman. So I picked up some Marathi too. And I get to go back every couple months. I was just there at the end of March, 2021.
That's gotta be hard, right? When you can't always be there in person to run the show. I know so many nonprofits, especially startup nonprofits, they've usually got one person that's the janitor and the CEO and doing everything in between, but you can't do that when you're running a nonprofit halfway around the globe.
Now you got to delegate. You have to raise up leaders. If you're going to be most effective, you have to multiply yourself.
How does one do that? How does someone multiply themselves?
Yes. Well, leadership is all about getting others to do the work for you. And if you want to make it sound even prettier, leadership is about getting others to do the work for you to reach a mission. Our mission is to get these kids out of poverty. So first, you have to find the people. And that can be a challenge, but you know, and people, you have to build a relationship. And so you'll get to know them and see how they act. And how do you build trust with somebody? Well, in order to build trust, you have to give trust. So that's what I do. I've given trust to leaders. And then when they show that they're faithful, give them a little bit more trust. And so that we have developed several leaders. In fact, with Love Never Fails International, we have 63 staff today. 53 of them are in India and 10 of them are in America.
That's fantastic. How many different centers are you guys running?
We have 20 centers from coast to coast in India, all across the country, to Mumbai, to Nagpur, the centermost point of the country, to Calcutta and Orissa, and many villages in between.
What was your first hire like? When I think of the first person that I'm going to hire, I think of the person that's going to fill the gaps that I'm not either fond of or I'm not an expert at. So I'm not going to be looking for someone that's just like me. I've got to look for someone that's not like me, someone that has different qualities. What did it look like when you got your first hire?
Well, it was a very challenging one because when I went to India, nobody gave me a paycheck. I started this organization. So I had to go ask people to give to me to do this work and help these kids with not a whole lot to show for. So I can remember my first hire. And it didn't just come because everything was going great and we had money and just needed to spend it on staff. In fact, I was working with local churches in Mumbai and they were providing volunteers. But the problem with these volunteers were they were not coming regularly. My mission was to provide regular service for these kids in the slums. So I met this one guy at church and I said, hey, listen, would you like to work with the children in the slums? I'd like to make a proposition for you. I said, I will pay you 100 rupees every class you come. I said, I need you 5 days a week. And he said, okay, I'll think about it. And he was the first hire. And then about a year later, I said, you're doing a great job. I'm really proud of you. I want to promote you to director over the couple other staff that we had. He said, I could never do that. I said, yes, you can. You have to believe in yourself first. And he has been such an asset to where we had somebody to contact us out of the blue from Africa that wanted to come and support our centers. And I said, okay, great. I had a little talk with him. I said, I'm going to put you in touch with our director, this person. And they loved him. They fell in love with him. They're like, oh my gosh, I absolutely love him. About 6-7 months later, they decided they were going to make us their designated organization to support in India. And so in 2020, we received probably over $200,000 from these people that met with the one employee that started at 100 rupees to be director to where he got that responsibility. So it started small.
How do you build trust with these people that you're obviously thousands upon thousands of miles away from? Are you worried about that? I know people in America, when they have someone here local that they see every day, they're like, I still don't know if I trust them. You're trusting someone that I don't know what's India, 10,000 plus miles away. What does that look like?
Yeah. You know what? I think it works better that you're so far away because sometimes if you're right there and you're in the office, you can have that tendency to micromanage. Micromanaging is when you're focused on the business side of things. Okay. When you're focused on leadership, you're focused on the people side of things, investing in your team, investing to get to know them. Hey, where's that document? You said it was going to be ready in a week. What happened? We need those reports in. Or how is your mom doing? You told me she was sick last week. How is your grandparents doing? Asking about their children. So that's one of the things I focus on, building the relationship to build trust. And you know, when we have a potential staff, you have to get to know this person in time. Time takes time. And then another thing, before we hire a director in India, because we have our eyes set on different states, then we have to have a director that's going to go there and spend time with this person before we start giving them small tasks. We don't just say, we're going to make you a level 5 Love Never Fail center. We have 5 levels of our centers and all levels. Level 1 will get the least amount of resources. Up to level 5, they're getting the most amount. So we're going to start with level 1. Here's some emergency relief. And this is how we want you to follow up with it, because we need pictures like this. And this is how we want you to distribute it. And let's agree on what items they're going to get and the cost. How do they do with that small task? If they can handle that, can they handle a construction project? You don't want to jump into the big things. So we start by giving trust in littler things and seeing how they handle it.
It's the same with that we treat our children, right? You say, hey, can you pick up your toys? Hey, can you do this? Oh, now we're going to give you the vacuum. Can you vacuum? Oh, go from vacuum to the lawnmower. And we do this inherently with our children, but somehow we forget to do this with our staff or our volunteers. We have all these unknown, unwritten expectations that when someone comes on board, they're going to be able to do things. One of the things I love about the military is they take a random person off the street that meets a set of minimum qualifications, but they train you and they assume that you've never had any training before. Does that cause some problems? Sometimes, yes. but it also ensures that everyone that leaves that school or that level of training has the same base level of knowledge. And then we go up and we work up from there. You have all these different on-the-job trainings, these different syllabuses that you have to complete. And many times you have tests, oral boards, and different kind of tasks you have to do in order to get certified. And then when you are certified, there's people checking up on you to make sure you're still doing it right. That's how the military works. But in other organizations, they forget to do these things, or they assume that someone says they're proficient at Excel on their resume, that it means they have the same level of knowledge that you do in Excel. And that's just not true. That's just not how that works. You expect them to have some level of functionality, but you really don't know what it is. It's not like you give them an Excel test to see if they understand and you understand exactly where you're at. You know, we don't do that. And I think that's one of the big fallacies, that to expect certain things when you haven't trained them on it. When I look at leadership at the basic level, and I'm going to give someone something to do, you know, have I trained them, or do I know that they're trained on whatever I'm going to give them to do? Do they have the capacity to do something like that? And capacity might mean bandwidth, right? Do they have the time available? Or it might be what you mentioned about a sick family member. Do they have the mental capacity to even, are they even at work today in their head? Are they even here working? Because they might not be. And then have I given them, if I told them what they do, I use Jim Mattis's 3-step communication process. What do I know? Who needs to know? Have I told them? Have I communicated what my expectations for this thing is? Have I given them some kind of timeline? Hey, I'm going to give you this task. And I don't tell them I expect it done before the end of the shift, before the end of the day, by the end of the week, by the end of the month. If I haven't told them that, then they don't know either. They're not mind readers. If they were mind readers, they wouldn't be working for me. That's for sure. They'd be off making billions of money in Dogecoin or something. Who knows? But we have to make sure that we have done these things and let them know that they're trained, capable, have the capacity, that I've set my expectations. And then the biggest one, to avoid micromanagement, you've got to leave. I joke in a few of these episodes, I say the 3 D's of leadership are delegate, delegate, disappear, because you can't delegate something and then stand over their shoulder and expect them to do it.
That's great, Travis. I love the 3 D's. I never heard of that until we first spoke, and I remember it very well. And it's so true, because although I never heard of the 3 D's, I was already doing it. And that's one of the ways that you're going to multiply your team. But, you know, I want to say something about accountability. A lot of times these organizations in America, what they're doing is they're sending money over there. It could be to a church. It could be to another organization. They don't really have accountability over them. And so what I found is, because I lived in India for 7 years, a lot of these even big, very famous organizations are sending their resources, just random people as they delegate as their contact. But they don't really have accountability, because they can't hire or fire them. They can give them resources, they can distribute it. So that's one thing I found, is you need to be able to delegate, but have accountability. Otherwise, delegation without accountability equals chaos.
I like that. Delegation without accountability equals chaos. This is a little departed from our standard discussion. I read an article, is either this morning or last night, I can't remember. And it was an inmate on death row writing a letter to his mother. And he said, if all things were equal, you'd be here in the chair next to me, because when I did this growing up, you didn't hold me accountable. You didn't say anything about it. When I did this, something more severe, you didn't say anything. You didn't hold me accountable. All these things that I did, all these indicators of bad behavior, you never held me accountable. And now when I got into the real world and they're holding me accountable, I wasn't trained for that kind of life, because I believe that if parents don't discipline their kids, if bosses don't hold their workers accountable, if we as citizens don't hold our politicians accountable, then we're authorizing that kind of behavior. And when we do that and something bad happens, and then we wonder what happened, that's on us. That is definitely on us. We have to have those systems in place. I work in aviation for the Navy, and everything has a worker and an inspector. when my wife works at a pharmacy, she's the worker, and then she's got the pharmacist that's the inspector. They make sure everything was done right. When we get into those situations where we're going too quickly and we don't let the process that we've put in place work and we just do things to get them done, that's when we have the most mistakes. That's when we're letting things fall through the cracks. There's a reason people that are writing college papers trying to get things done, like their thesis or dissertation, that's why they hire an editor. That's why authors hire an editor, because we don't catch everything. It's hard to see the label when you're in the box. You have to have someone else with you. And if we don't hold people accountable, if we don't hold people to that standard, we create problems. I know so many things. They say that people don't leave a job, they leave a manager. And I see that that's true in every sense of the word. And one of the biggest things that frustrates me as someone that works is when I see a standard not being enforced, when some people can get away with it and some people can't. That's something that really creates a hostile work environment and creates problems when some people are being held accountable and some people are not. Do you find that that's true in your line of work?
Yeah, because a lot of the things we do at one center, we do at many. So you get to see how these directors, they want to operate. And I'll tell them, this is like your own business. This is what you make of it. This is your center. It's in your community. And you'll see some people, they'll cut corners and you can talk to them. And, you know, a lot of times they're very humble and they're like, okay, sorry. But if you keep letting things slip, things will go. You know, we had let a staff go from our office in New Jersey. And so I went in and I was looking at some of the database and I said, oh, they were like cutting some corners. They were getting the job done. You know, at least it was 50%. You know, I've learned if somebody can do it 50%, let them go, but try to improve them, you know, so you can't expect perfection. Then I looked at a form and I said, oh, that's not the correct form that they were getting back and forth from India that comes from our child sponsorship. And I said, oh, this person here was doing the work in the office to edit this form when they could have just sent the form, the master copy, to India, this one location, and they could have sent it back correctly and they didn't have to take 5 minutes on each form to correct, where we get a couple each day. I said, wow, you know, so they're gone now, but if they were here, I would have said something to them, you know, like, listen, you're making more work. It might take you a little time to update the form or talk with them and correct them, but ultimately this is a form that's going to be used a lot.
Yeah. You got to find out if it's the person or the process. And then you've got to give them the benefit of the doubt. How many times you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know, and you make the first mistake, it's a mistake. When they make it again, it's a choice. They've chosen not to learn or implement things that help them do things better in the military, especially in aviation. When you make a mistake, you've earned yourself the right to write a checklist. Either there was a checklist that you didn't follow, there was a checklist that you did follow that wasn't correct, or you try to do something without a checklist. So myself, when I started this podcast, I recorded an episode, this great interview, and I was done. I closed the Zoom screen and you expect this little pop-up that says it is processing. And I closed the screen and that pop-up didn't pop up. And I was like, oh, I didn't hit the record button. And then I told my boss about it. And he's like, well, sounds like you earned yourself the right to write a checklist. I was like, I did. So now I have a little sticky behind my computer screen that says, look at the camera, smile, hit record. And it's just one of those things that you might not think about until you get to a place where, I didn't make the mistake. I didn't know this thing. I didn't understand. And if you're the boss and you're trying to figure out what this might look like in your organization, what it might look like is you're answering the same type of question on a regular basis, or they're following a policy or a procedure that's been put in place and they have questions. Well, if they come to you with questions, then the policy or the procedure wasn't written correctly. And it's time for a revision, a little update, some clarifying language, maybe a graphic, whatever the thing is. And then when you put that back in place and put it back out into the work, all of those questions should go away. When I wrote the ultimate podcast guide, I said, please, please, please come back to me with questions. I want to make sure I have the best product available. So if you're asking questions, my guide isn't good enough and I want to update that thing. So we help all the other people behind you get all to the right answers, because has got the most complete and up-to-date information. And people are like, really? What? That's interesting. Why would you? That doesn't sound like a lot of people are doing that thing. Why do you want to say that? I'm like, I don't want to have a garbage product on the street. I don't want to have you buy an ebook from me that gives you that bad taste in your mouth because it's not what you thought it was. This is a no bad aftertaste product because I don't want to put anything out that's going to try to ruin my name. Do you find that having the correct procedures and policies is important, especially working remotely 10,000 miles away from where you're doing business?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wish I would have thought about that earlier, but you know, after enough pain, it will move you in the right direction. So what we have is called the playbook. So if somebody, let's say they want to say, how do you process a new child sponsorship? They can go into that playbook and step by step, it's going to tell them. And there's probably about 20 steps in there. And just think, before these playbooks were written a couple of years ago, each person that would come on the team, they would have to learn it. And it was only through mouth. Okay, and then practice a little bit. Now we can delegate to them faster, because they have a list, they have a guide, and we keep adding to the playbook. And in fact, the other day I was adding a couple of things. It's like, why don't we have that in a playbook? I said, let me go and add it. And I put a couple other things in there that I thought would be helpful. So if somebody says, okay, what to do for that? It's in the playbook. There you go. Go check it out. And then if they have questions, they can always come and they can ask.
Yeah. See, I like that. That's fantastic.
But you know what, Travis, I want to say something as we're talking about, you know, getting these people in and delegating. Another way to multiply your team is that I believe is one of the biggest mistakes is, well, let me ask you, who are you going to choose? The person that's smarter or the person that has greater belief in themselves?
Oh, that's a good question. We were just talking about this before we started. We were talking about Tim Tebow getting signed with the Jags and what that might look like. He's not there as a quarterback. He's been out of the system for 6 years. You know, what is the reason that he was hired? And one of the things that you mentioned was maybe it's because of the belief that he brings to the team. Urban Meyer was obviously his college coach, and belief is a huge part of everything. Everything stems from belief, your beliefs, thoughts, feelings, and actions. And if you want to change any of those, you have to get down to the core belief, and that has to be in alignment before you can move forward. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about, because you need somebody that is one going to believe in your mission. What are you trying to accomplish? Are they a believer in that? They could be the most skilled person, but belief is going to trump skill. Because if they're not buying in, if they don't believe in the mission, how long are they going to stay? Number two, they have to believe in themselves. Have you ever met a person just no matter what, they're like, I'll get it done. I can do it. I'll give it my best. That's the person you want on your team, because they say 20% of the people that you choose are already going to be motivated. It's just, you can't get caught up focusing on the 80% that are not naturally motivated. You know, you about 50% of the staff, they're going to be like in maintenance mode. Just get the job done. Okay. And yeah, let's just let it roll. But they're not visionaries. The 20% are the visionaries that believe in the mission. They believe in themselves. They want to take it to the next step. I was in India the end of March, and I was with our top director. Okay. And he's earned that because he's shown he wants to step up. He wants to go above and beyond. He's a visionary. And we have a very fairly large construction project going on. He's over there yelling with all the builders, and he's got his architectural plans out. He's just a director over the staff and the children. We have a building company that we hired, okay? He's telling, you didn't make this right. I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I was like, just relax. But in my mind, he's taking ownership. I didn't have to tell him. When you overlook this project, you take ownership. You treat it like your whole family's moving. Never had to tell him, because he's already in the top 20%. So who do you want? The person with all the skill and not really believing, or the person that's believing that you can shape and mold? You want the believer.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember a few years ago hearing the difference between a coach hiring a baseball player, the guy that runs with perfect form, or the guy that runs with terrible form, but just as fast. And the answer is terrible form, but just as fast, because you can fix the form and make it faster. Yeah. Too many people think you've got to walk in ready to do things. I was reading a study a few years ago that talked about some of the differences between men and women. And, you know, spoiler alert, of course, this doesn't apply to everyone. So before I get a bunch of angry messages and emails, this is just generally speaking. Generally speaking, a man is willing to ask for a raise or promotion when he's like 65% qualified or ready for the next position. And ladies in general, you have to be 90 or 95% to feel that it's okay to ask for the next role. So who's right? Who's wrong? I don't think it's either is right or wrong, but it's the difference in what they think is appropriate for that next level. Guys really are designed and wired, again, generally speaking, for that achievement, for that next level, for that next thing, because that's part of how we define ourselves. And ladies in general don't feel the same way. So I got to wonder if that has something to do with how we're looking at the different gender roles in America right now, saying, oh, ladies only make X amount of money per, you know, their same experience level against their peers and all that, is one of the reasons that the guys are just asking for it earlier and the ladies are not. Could be. I don't know everything, but that has a lot to do with how things happen in the workplace. That desire for that next thing, that desire for that next level, taking ownership, showing initiative. Men and women, generally speaking, look at it in different ways.
That's true. And that makes me think of the abundance mindset versus the scarcity mindset. You know, this morning I had a meeting with our senior director in India. And I'm just thinking, as we're talking about belief versus skill, he doesn't have a college degree. We do have directors that went to college. His English is not that good. English is his third language. We do have directors that went to English school and they speak excellent English, but he's getting paid more than the other directors. He also has more responsibility because he has that belief system built into him that he can do it. Sometimes I look at his reports that he sends. I'm like, who made that? He's like, I did. And I'm like, wow, this guy, he must have spent a lot of time on it. I said, but he believed that he can accomplish it. And it's very helpful to see everything broken down so good that I can give it to a major donor. And I'm like, man, this is like making us look good. And we talked about this morning, he has a major building project going on in one area. We talked about two more building projects on top of the other, which will be the third that he would be over. You think I'm not waiting to give him a raise? You think I don't want to make sure he stays with our organization and he's well taken care of? Because he also can multiply.
Yeah, those leaders with belief and trust are probably the top two things. Well, belief, trust, and integrity. Belief, integrity, and trust. Just a little bit. Simon Sinek was doing a presentation talking about the Navy SEALs, and he loves the way the special forces look at things and do things, and they have a different perspective. He says they will take someone that they trust fully who doesn't yet have the skill over a person that has all the skills, but they don't trust. Because when they're out doing a mission and it's just the people next to you with not a lot of support, trust is their top factor in determining if the mission is going to be successful or not, if they're going to integrate within the team, if they're going to be able to go out, you know, Lord knows where to do something and it's going to work. They're going to pick the person that they trust over everything else. So if you're in a nonprofit and you're looking around and you have people around you that you don't trust, got to ask you what they're doing there. You know, Jonathan made a good point bringing up the difference between abundance and scarcity. I don't judge people. I don't do a lot of things other people do. But one thing I do is I categorize people. When I meet someone or I interact with someone, I put them in either the abundance or the scarcity column until they prove me wrong or change or do something differently. I am not interested in people that talk about lack of resources, that talk about obstacles, talk about competition with other nonprofits. Because I don't believe that that's true. I think that there is abundant resources. I think that obstacles are just challenges and a new way to learn and grow and something else to build off of. And that's the kind of people that I want to be around. I want to be in my life. I want to work with. I had someone get a hold of me yesterday that wanted to sit down to a meeting to get some consulting. And I could tell from the little pre-conversation we had that I wasn't interested in working with them. Even if they would pay me double or triple, not interested, because I know where their mindset's at. And I know that they're not willing to listen or grow or change. Those are the kind of people that I want to be around. Those are the people that I want in my life, in my inner circle. When I talk about people in my inner circle, and I think I've talked about this before, people in my inner circle, when I get off a phone call, I feel fantastic. I know they feel fantastic. Everyone feels elevated. Everyone feels like they've learned something. Everyone knows on that conversation, know that the other person cares about them. I did a little intentional gratitude. Gratitude is a verb. It requires action. And I shared my inner circle list with the people in my inner circle. I said, hey, I want you to know you and your spouse and your children, they're on my list. And I think about, pray about, meditate daily on the people on my list. I wanted to know that you're in my inner circle. And I had a gal was like, oh, I love that. You're definitely in my inner circle. As like, is it written down? And then this morning she sent me a little picture of it actually written down, because she's practicing that intentionality. Someone that I knew it was on their list, but they didn't have the list written down. What are some things that you write down?
Every day I write down three goals. It's so simple, my journaling. I write down three goals. Then I write down three prayers. Could be for me, could be for someone else. And then I write down whatever's left. It's just a regular notebook, regular size, you know, college bound. I write down gratitudes, grateful. I'm grateful for, and whatever space I got, it's usually about 10 things I write down. So every day I'm writing down three goals, three prayers, and then the grateful list. Then I review it after I write it. I let it sink in. I look at the goals. I pray for each one specifically. And I go back over the gratitude. And that helps me to get started my day.
Isn't a great way to start your day is to start with gratitude? I know my grandma used to always say the only attitude that matters is the attitude of gratitude. And when you're there, everything else is in alignment. And I love, love, love that about her. As a woman that always had a smile on her face and always had $5 for me because she was sure that she forgot my birthday. You know, like, oh, I'm sure you've had a birthday since I've seen you, which is just wonderful. How do you deal with employees that bring problems to you? How do you handle that interaction? What does that look like? Is that a here's the answer, get out? Is that a teachable moment? Are you training them? How do you handle those things?
Everybody wants to be seen and heard. So I always try to practice that. Let them be seen. Let them be heard. And, you know, one of the differences you can tell of micromanaging leading is a leader is going to ask twice as many questions as they give answers. So I'll ask them to try to get insight, to find out a little bit more about what's going on and listen to them. Because a lot of times people just want somebody that's going to hear them and see them.
I know we were talking before the show about things of this nature, and I have a very different approach than a lot of other trainers, a lot of other bosses. When someone comes to me with a problem, like a legitimate problem, I don't give them an answer or solution. And a lot of people are frustrated with me for doing this, because what I do is I ask them questions and I walk them through the process of how to solve their own problem. And some people get grumpy with it. Like, why can't you just give me the answer? And here's the deal. If I give you the answer, then when you walk away, you either know the answer or you don't. If I'm not around, you either remember it or you don't remember it. But if we walk through and teach you the process of how to figure out the answer, then whether I'm there or not, you can remember it, not remember it, or you can know how to figure it out and find the answer on your own. It doesn't do anyone any good if you don't know how to figure it out when I'm not in the room. And a lot of people are frustrated with that. A lot of new trainees are like, just give me the answer. I'm like, I'm not your teacher in high school. I don't owe you the answer. Giving you the answer doesn't help you. It might help you now. It might help you for the next 10 minutes, but is it going to help you 3 weeks from now? And 3 weeks from now, when that question comes up again, are you going to know the answer? Are you going to know how we got to that answer? Are you going to know why that answer matters? If the answer is no, then I'm not doing you any favors by just giving you the answer. And it's interesting to see different reactions. Another thing that happens is when people bring a larger problem to the office and say, hey, I need help with this big thing. And I send them away. And it's like, hey, come back with three potential solutions. Consider this, consider this, consider this. And they go out and they do the work and they come back. And I'm like, well, which one would you choose? And why would you choose it? And are these three legitimate answers? And again, they're like, they get frustrated and like, why are you doing this? I'm like, I'm teaching you how to creatively problem solve and how to creatively go through with an answer and figure out why one is going to be more viable than another one. And if we can implement that. And they're like, I had two guys that were working for me when I was younger in the Navy. And I took this approach with them and they were both super frustrated with me. And then I left. I had a few months before I left and I was doing this. I was letting them take the reins, letting them be in charge. And it was their, you know, as a safety net, anything they had problems with. And they were frustrated. Like, you're not doing nothing. I'm like, you just don't see it yet. Right. You don't understand yet. Like, we're going out here, we're working, we're doing this stuff. And you're just sitting in here. Well, I'm taking care of some different things, but yeah, I understand how you'd feel that way. And a few months went by after I checked out, after I left, and I got calls from them back to back days. And they both called me and they said, you know what, when this was happening, I wasn't happy about it. I felt like you weren't pulling your weight. You weren't doing anything. And he's like, the second that you left and it was on me, I knew exactly what to do. I knew exactly how to handle this situation. I knew exactly what I needed to do. And in fact, I have waited so long to call you because I was kind of embarrassed because I instantly figured out what you were doing and how it was the right way to do it. And the same call from both the guys. One of those individuals went on to do bigger and better things. And the other one got picked up to go work for the Blue Angels. So they understood and implemented the things that we talked and the things that we trained about. It was a fantastic experience, although they didn't feel that way initially.
No, because you built confidence in them. If somebody comes to you, you know, one of the ways, you know, with leadership, it's, you don't want to be micromanaging everybody because you're going to hurt yourself and hurt them. When somebody comes to you, if you just give them the answer and send them the way, you're going to be doing them harm. Here's one of the ways, you know, if you're micromanaging, if you're getting interrupted every 20, 30 minutes from a staff, you're probably micromanaging because they have to go figure it out. You tell them, no, just figure it out. Okay. And come back and then let me know how you plan on going about solving that problem. And then you're actually instilling confidence in them. There's times I just don't have time and I've heard staff and they're like, oh, thank you so much for trusting me. You're really building my confidence. So I didn't learn all these things, you know, just because I read it in a book. It was like, oh, I didn't have time to give them anyway. And they're saying this is a good thing. I better take note and redo that.
I've got a mentor, Stephen Kuhn, and he was episode number 50 on the show. He talks about how to make your website an active employee, and he's got three nonprofits making $200,000 a month. So if you haven't listened to that episode, hop back and listen to that episode. But he talks about creating space with the people around you, coming into the room with no expectations and working through things. If I give people the answers all the time, that's only going to solve a problem in the way that we currently know how to solve the problem. The only way you're going to get to a solution for something that's not yet solved is for me to not give the answer. I have to allow them the space and the bandwidth to go out and attack this thing from a new point of view, a new perspective. Because if I just give them the answer, doing it the way we've always done it, I'm not going to get a new result. Maybe the way I know was good 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now that is by far the hardest way to do business, the longest way to an answer. And there's so many other tools out there that I just haven't known about, I'm not familiar with yet. If I give them the answer, I prevent that new solution. And I am not willing to compromise new solutions just to get my way or do it the thing that I'm most comfortable with.
Yeah. Also, we're creating learned helplessness with our team.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Learned helplessness is the worst thing. And it seems more prevalent in the younger generations where they just feel like you have to tell them everything what to do. If you can get a person out of that, then how much more beneficial they'll be for you to reach your mission.
Yeah, without a doubt. learned helplessness. We were talking before the show started about something as simple as changing the way we write word problems in math in elementary, middle, and high school. Because the current model says, I have $10, thing I want to buy costs $250. How many things can I buy? That's a consumer mindset. That's a worker mindset. We could easily rewrite that statement to say, I have $250. The thing I want costs $250, but I got to buy four of them. How much more do I need to earn? And all of a sudden, you're looking at the same problem from a different viewpoint. You understand that you might have to make $7.50 in order to get what you want. And you can also add, how many widgets do I need to sell in my business in order to earn this much profit to get the thing I need? And when you look at it from just a little bit different perspective, you get a whole new thought process and a whole new way of looking at life.
Absolutely. You know, I feel like I'd be doing your listeners a disservice if I didn't say one thing that helped me the most to really multiply staff and team. You don't have to be great to start, but you have to start in order to be great. And what I want to say off of that is start small. If you're an executive director, if you started a nonprofit, and you wear all the hats and you know that you need somebody to help you, you don't have to hire a full-time position. I've seen people posting in groups with 30,000 plus on Facebook and they're like, oh, we got to hire. We don't know what to do with payroll. We don't know what to do with benefits. We don't know this. How are we going to pay them? But if we, and I'm like, just start small. Hire somebody for 1 hour a week. You don't have to go for the grand slam on your first hire. Hire somebody for 2 hours a week. You can do that. That was one of the things that helped me the most when somebody told me, just start small. I hired somebody for 100 rupees a day. There was no contract, no nothing, you know, but it was a starting point. I had to get somebody to go to Upwork.com, hire a virtual assistant, hire a graphic designer to do one project that you don't do. It'll probably look a lot better too. And it's going to be a lot less stressful. Start with one thing in the week. Give 1 hour to delegate a project to and slowly build your way up.
Yeah, absolutely. There's many episodes that I've done where we talk about how to find volunteers, how to find quality volunteers. Use a volunteer. Use someone in college that needs a resume boost. You have to go out and find these people and cultivate them and develop them just as you would a hire. But don't just do it by yourself because you're not unsure how to move forward with this thing. When I started this podcast, I didn't have a set audience. I wasn't sure what I was going to be talking about, but I knew I wanted to do something in the nonprofit world. And I started this thing. And now we've got all the accolades and people love us and whatever have you. But that wasn't day one. Day one, I recorded an episode and I threw it out there to see what happens. You know, now I'm getting in 1 week, I'm getting more downloads than I got in the first 6 months. And it's not because I don't know what I'm doing or anything like that. It just takes a jump off point. The hardest part is starting, but man, is it a lot easier to turn the car or steering wheel when you're in motion as opposed to when you're stopped. It's a lot easier to adjust and change directions. And you're going to adjust, you're going to change directions. When you look at something like your mission, that's only one piece of it. You want to provide service X to people Y. That's it. Jonathan wants to provide education to children in India to help them get out of poverty. The vision is something different, right? The vision might be all kids in India speak English, are educated, and are on the right track. And all the little goals in between are the steps on the mountain where the vision's at the top. The strategy, that's something that's going to change on a regular basis. You've got these sweeping winds that are coming around the mountain, pushing you and pulling you. And the average is seven different times you're going to change strategies before you get to the vision. Don't change the vision, change the strategy. Take something, start with it. Tell your staff, be like, hey, we're going to try this thing and we're going to go this way. It's probably not going to work. We're going to need input. We're going to need to adjust course. You know, an airplane doesn't take off, set a heading and go. They get called by air traffic control and they get called by centers. Hey, you got to reroute. I need you to go around this obstacle. We've got other planes in the area. We've got heavy traffic. Go up to this altitude, go down to that altitude. You can't get to work by driving in a straight line. You've got to turn the corner here. You got to turn the corner there. But somehow when we're applying this to our business or our nonprofit, we said, well, that's the strategy we're going with. And it's either going to work or it won't. Chances are it won't. Don't feel bad. It's not a bad strategy. That got you off the starting line, but you're going to have to incorporate different things, different ways of looking at the problem. The way it gets you to your first $10,000 is probably not the same strategy that's going to get you to $100,000. And it's probably a different strategy to get to $200,000 a month than it did to get you to your first $100,000. There's nothing wrong with that. That's how it works. That's how we got 7-Up. There was a soda maker back in the 1800s that wanted to create something, and formula number one didn't take, number two didn't take, three number take, four didn't take, five didn't take, number six didn't take, and he quit. And he sold the formula to another gentleman, and they reformulated one more time to get to 7-Up, and that's what stuck. And 7-Up's been in manufacture however many years that is, in the late 1800s till now, because they changed strategies and they finally got to the one that worked. The strategy I used to promote the nonprofit architect on day one is not the strategy I'm using today. You have to be willing to change and update. Keep that vision the same. Make sure you're hitting goals that are going to get you towards there. But the strategies to do the things that you're trying to do are going to change and evolve over time as technology changes, knowledge changes, and the things that people prefer, people's preferences are going to change. You got to change the way you're doing business. John, before we started our last conversation, you mentioned something about the person you wish you had when you were younger. Remind me what that is. What does that look like?
I wish I had somebody that was there to encourage me and to teach me things that the school's not going to teach you. You know, one is if you fail, don't give up. The Bible says that a righteous person falls 7 times, but gets back up. But too many times we fail 1 or 2 times and we feel like, oh, it's, okay, it's not meant to be. And you know what? I felt like I failed so many times when I started Love Never Fails International. I couldn't even get a person to stay. It felt so hard. I was like, I was looking for that first staff. It was so difficult. And, you know, now I talk with the board and staffing, you know, challenges we have in America. I'm like, this is nothing compared to India. Now we have a lot more staff, but there was challenges. I wish I had somebody to teach me those things. Don't give up. Somebody that's going to teach me to believe in myself. That don't just focus on running off and getting a college degree, but focus on building yourself up so you believe, you have confidence in yourself. You know, somebody that would also guide me in my faith. Because when I look back and, you know, when I bought a Lexus and lived in a nice house, I didn't feel the happiest in my life when I had those things. You know, in fact, when I had left being a teacher in New Jersey and went off to India with nobody giving me a paycheck, just asking people to support me. And, you know, in my mind, Love Never Fails was there. On paper, it wasn't. You know, it was still formulating. And so I was the happiest person. You know, India, as you know, most Indians have the same last name, right? Patel, Patel. Then you get to some areas that change. It's Patil, 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 Patel, Patel. It varies, you know, and they have a lot of the same names. Well, I used to say, out of 1.3 billion people, I'm the only Jonathan Krause. There's only one of me, and I'm the happiest person in the whole country. I rented a room where 12 people shared the bathroom. So there was a lot of surprises in that bathroom, you know. But I was happy, and I wish somebody would have told me when I was a kid that you don't need things to make you happy. Happiness is an inside job. You have to believe in yourself. Work on your faith. My faith is in Jesus Christ. That's what really fulfills me, gives me a purpose to follow. And then also, don't just focus on yourself, but give back to others. Now you were helped. Now pass this along to another person. So I often think of the kids that we serve, that we can be the people that we wish we had when we were younger. So these kids that are living in poverty, which before COVID even came, it was already a crisis in these slums. No running water, no toilets in their homes. Forget about, I don't know, PS4, is that the thing? I haven't played games for a long time, you know, but I'm all for having fun. I just don't have a game system. So these kids, they don't have anything compared to us in America. But one thing you can find some of them with is joy, because they've accepted their circumstances, and some of them will move on from that with a little help from the right person and believing in themselves.
I tell you what, I can't think of a better way to wrap up our discussion today than ending on joy. Jonathan, this has been fantastic. Where can people find you and get a hold of you?
Yes, come visit us at loveneverfailsindia.com. We also have a Facebook page at Love Never Fails India. Please come visit us, see the work that we're doing. If you felt led, sponsor a kid in India to where you'll get updates on these children, the child that you sponsor.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Travis.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.